Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Dear Prudence. I'm your Prudence, Janae Desmond Harris. Today I'll be answering letters from readers with dilemmas about friends who are terrible writers, coworkers who use therapy speak, and whether it's a good idea to travel with an ex. Spoiler, it is not, unless my guest disagrees with me. To help me answer these questions, I'll be joined by Aisha Harris. She's a culture critic, author, and podcaster. She's co-host for NPR's hit podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour, and the author of her debut book, Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me. It's a collection of original essays out June 13th. I asked her for three facts about herself that do not appear in her bio, just so you know a little more about who's giving you advice today. So here they are. Number one, she earned a black belt in Tang Soo Do when she was 12. Two, she spent two summers in high school and college working at a homemade ice cream shop, whose acronym boiled down to the unfortunate spelling KKK. They have thankfully since changed the name. And three, in college, her dance group participated in a drag show competition and won second place for an elaborately choreographed number to Lil' Kim's How Many Licks. They deserve first place, she says, but it's whatever. Anyway, we'll be back after a short break. The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and, did I mention, Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Welcome back. You're listening to Dear Prudence, and I'm here with Aisha Harris. Hey, Aisha.
Janae, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you. Thank you so much. I'm definitely going to need your help with some of these today. So let's go ahead and dive right in. Our first letter is titled Novel Personality Transplant.
I have an issue with my good friend, Jake. Jake and I are both passionate writers doing our best to get our fiction published while working other jobs. We've supported each other, reading each other's work and offering feedback, always gentle, for the last 2 years. Normally, I love his work and would highly recommend it. Recently, however, he started a new novel that is almost unreadable. I don't mean that it's badly written, so much as it's wildly pretentious, the characters are horrible, and he doesn't seem to mean for them to be, and the single woman in this new work, in a cast of multiple complex male characters, is two-dimensional, and we're introduced to her by a description of her cleavage. I raised that with him right away, sending him a message asking if she was going to be the only female character and why her chest was relevant to the narrative, and he was dismissive of my criticism and said it was written that way because we're supposed to see her from the main character's point of view, and the main character is attracted to her. He sent me an update of the work recently, and it is possibly the worst thing I've ever read. Truly. There is literally a scene in which a crowd of people on a train stop having their own conversation to listen admiringly to the main character talking pretentious crap about the nature of stupidity in the masses to his friends. And we are supposed to believe that this man is so bewilderingly attractive that people stop and gaze at him in the streets. It's worse than stuff I wrote as a full of myself teenager. And Jake is 30. It sounds ridiculous, but I'm genuinely worried about him. His work before this was nuanced, clever, well-structured, and with amazing characterization. This is such a sudden and such a stark contrast that I'm worried it's symptomatic of something he's going through, though there have been no big life changes that I know of, and he seems normal in conversation, until I bring up the new work, however gently, at which point he dismisses even the smallest concerns and seems incapable of hearing criticism, also not like him. I don't know what to say beyond what I've already said, and I'm unsure how to deter him from sending me more of this without being really brutal at this point. Can you advise on what I should say to him and whether or not you think I'm missing something that might be going on with him? The new novel reads like it's written by a totally different author, and I would absolutely not be friends with the author if this was all I knew them by. It's such misogynistic, narrow-minded, pretentious drivel.
Okay, I like that the letter writer divided this into two questions. One, what should I say to him about how terrible his work is? And two, am I missing something that's going on with him? So let's put two aside for right now.
Yeah.
Aisha, I kind of want to know what you think about one, because you don't write fiction, but you've sent your work out for people to read. You've also,
including you.
Yes, including me. And I think, honestly, I was just like, this is so good. I don't have any edits. We've both been editors. We've worked together as editors. So I know that you have given people tough feedback. And you're a cultural critic. So I think the first question I wanted to raise for you is, like, what do you make of this idea that if there's someone in a book who's like misogynistic or a jerk, that that's an endorsement of that? I guess I'm wondering if there's a defense of this guy's work, that like he's writing a book about someone who's unlikable, and it doesn't mean that he's endorsing or promoting that. Is there any space for that? Or I don't know. What was your reaction?
So part of what makes this tough for me is that, like, I've only really had to edit people. I mean, you and I have sent each other stuff in the past. Mm-hmm. But mostly I've only had, when I was an editor, I wasn't editing my friends. So right. I get the issue and sort of the concern here. I think when it comes to this idea of characters who, this is the whole like likable, unlikable, abhorrent, whatever characters. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite shows of all time is It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. All of the characters on that show are horrific. They are mm-hmm. misogynistic. They are borderline rapey. They are racist, violent, everything horrible. And yet, what the show has been able to do over the last, like, I think it's going on 16 or 17 seasons now, is really, like, evolve from beyond just saying, like, these characters are horrible people, but also it's very clear that the people around them also receive them that way, and that there are people calling them out for being terrible. They also, like, seem miserable and unhappy. Like, it's very obvious that, you know, the creators are not endorsing this behavior. Whereas when, like, there's other examples of that kind of thing, Family Guy, for instance, where you can be a little less sure if the creator is actually, like, very aware of what they are contributing and what they are putting out there into the world when it comes to actual misogynistic and racist characters. So I guess, like, without knowing more about what this story is about, like, maybe the friend Jake is actually, like, doing something more along the lines of the Always Sunny folks. And mm-hmm. maybe that is what his intention is. Although it also sounds like
the character, at least according to the letter writer, thinks that the one female character is very one-dimensional. And I think, like, you kind of have to have a balance of, like, maybe, yes, this is the way the character sees her, but can you present her, you know, in a way that, like, the reader can also see another side of her? So I guess my feeling is that it's very possible that it could be either way, that, like, this letter writer is correct, and this is not this friend's best work, and maybe they are missing some nuance here. But it's also possible that maybe the letter writer is just, like, so incensed with the way these characters are written that maybe they're not seeing that there might be a little bit more. It also sounds like the story's not quite done yet, so right. Who knows? So I don't know. I want to give the letter writer and their friend, like, a little bit of, you know, grace here. It could be multiple ways.
It could be that he means well and he's just not very talented, right?
Like, yeah, that's also very possible.
I'm wondering if you're getting upset reading his work and he's not taking the criticism, I wonder if this this workshopping relationship needs to continue. And it doesn't necessarily, just because you're two friends who have always given each other feedback, it doesn't have to continue to be that way if what you're saying is not helpful to him and it's not a rewarding process for you. I would be interested in what kind of feedback Jake is giving her on her writing. Like, is he like, your women characters need more cleavage? That would be a giveaway that he's becoming a bad person. Reading this, I did, like, Google around. Sometimes I just like to get a little perspective. And I found a blog post by a writer, Emma Darwin, called Giving Feedback, How to Make It Really Useful. And she says, your job is not to win the argument. Once you've tried to explain what you mean, even if they don't seem to take it on board, let alone agree, the ball is now in their court and you must leave them in peace to deal with it. And I think that might be a helpful framework for the letter writer to use to think about this, which is just, he's asked for feedback and you've given it. Your job is just to give it. It's not to change the book. Like, you're not his editor.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And if you are friends outside of this, like, workshopping relationship, perhaps you want to salvage, like, maintain that relationship. And like you said, Janae, maybe it is time for that sort of part of your relationship to, it's run its course. And now you just need to, like, focus on being friends and maybe, you know, supporting each other, perhaps in different ways. If the book turns out to be what this letter writer considers to be, like, the final product is just, like, misogynistic drivel or pretentious drivel, you know, cheer from afar. Mm-hmm. Or, like, you know, you don't have to necessarily support in the same way that you did. And that's just the nature of friendship anyway. Like, it's going to evolve. It's not going to always be the same. And I don't know. I guess the other part of the question, though, is, like, they wonder if something might be going on.
Yeah.
So, like, then that makes that part of it also, like, okay, so are there any other aspects of this friendship where you think, oh, maybe this person is listening to too much Andrew Tate these days?
Right.
And, like, is he kind of taking the path that many men, I don't know how old these people are, but, like, it sounds like they're probably in their 20s or 30s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is this guy turning into a radical in some ways that you don't want to know? But, like, it's hard to tell from the letter, because it sounds like this is only so far showing up in his work and mm-hmm. not in the way he interacts with her. So I don't know. That seems it seems like jumping to a conclusion a little too soon.
I think the letter writer hates the writing so much that she wants to diagnose him as, like, an incel or, you know, some far right weirdo. And I think that actually if she's not noticing this in day to day life, if he's not, like, ranting about how he's a high value man and women need to whatever, I think it's safe to say that he's just doing a kind of writing that you don't like. Or maybe he is just not good at the kind of writing he wants to be doing, which is the most mm-hmm. generous interpretation. And it's probably fair to feel that you two can still be friends. Maybe have a conversation, like, ask him how things are going for him, how he's feeling, how things are going, you know, with the dating life, with work, with how he's feeling about his place in the world, I think it's okay to do a little bit of poking, but not a sit down that's like, you had a whole paragraph on her cleavage and I'm just worried about you.
Yeah. No interventions needed.
Yeah,
yet.
Exactly. Like
this, it sounds like, you know, this, and it, also, it just sounds like he's a writer who's maybe trying something new. And if you think about, there's many times where, you know, creators try to do something very different from what they did before, and they don't do it well, or they like overestimate their, and I'm not someone who believes that you should ever like just write what you know. I think people should be able to write things that are outside of their comfort zone or outside of their experience. But like you have to be very delicate and intentional and thoughtful about it. And a lot, if not most people who, especially if they are of a certain demographic, are not always very good about doing that. And so this also could just be, you know, a dude who is trying something new and is maybe, according to the letter writer, epically failing, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's like gonna go off and become a Proud Boy or something.
You know? Exactly. So I hope there's like, I just want to think about some other ways quickly that she could support him as a friend and a fellow writer. So I'm thinking, have writing dates in coffee shop, hold each other accountable for like writing a chapter or an essay or whatever it is by a certain deadline, take a workshop together. I think there's a lot of ways to continue this writing relationship without you having to be like infuriated and frustrated by how bad he is at it, in your opinion.
Yeah. And then, you know, if it ever gets published, or, you know, he publishes something similar in the future, I think you can just say congratulations and keep it moving. Like, you don't have to like, I also would like, maybe this sounds like maybe the letter writer also wants to like vent to other people like about it, and, you know, find one person to vent it to, but don't go on a tour about like, how, oh, this is terrible. Like, just let it be, let it lie.
Exactly. Okay. So that was a good warm up. The next question might be a little more challenging. Are you up for it?
As ready as I ever will be.
This letter is titled Boundaries Blues.
How can I deal with a colleague who overuses therapy speak in a professional environment? My coworker Elise has been with the company for about a year and is a recent grad, just a handful of years younger than me, so this isn't a boomer complaint about kids these days. I've started collaborating with her more frequently on joint projects in the last few months, and have noticed that she's quick to decide that she won't be doing X, Y, or Z task because she's setting a boundary. Let me state clearly that I strongly believe in maintaining a healthy work-life balance, and though I don't use the phrase setting a boundary in this context, I do consciously choose to avoid checking email during non-work hours, refuse to stay late without compensation, and always take my full break. I have no issue with people saying no to things that are detrimental to their mental or physical health or that are outside the scope of their role. However, Elise has been citing her boundaries when it comes to tasks that are literally part of her job. For example, once I asked her to send a completed project file to her supervisor and she said no, she wasn't able to do that. I must have seemed confused because she said, "It's a boundary I've set," without elaborating. At this point, I was so focused on just getting the project out that I did it myself without questioning further. I first thought that perhaps she preferred to not deal with that supervisor specifically due to personal or professional disagreements, but she's used the boundary line in multiple other situations, like when asked to prepare a section of a presentation or proofread another colleague's work. Basically, normal things that are part of our jobs, and not an unrealistic expectation for someone in her role. I don't really know how to handle this tendency. In the moment, in the interest of trying to keep the momentum going, I try to steer the conversation towards what she is willing to do and encourage the team to assign her those tasks, but I'm still weirdly bothered by her invocation of boundaries in these moments. I think she's trying to apply therapy speak / self-improvement lexicon to a setting where it doesn't apply. She's overall a good employee who turns in quality work when it's not something she's objected to, so I'm not saying she's lazy and using therapy speak to get out of doing any work whatsoever. It's just weird, and feels sort of unfair that she's using this phrase to avoid doing things that are standard for the job. I'd honestly rather she just say she doesn't want to do something rather than using this code word. Is it something to go to our supervisor about, or just deal with it? I truly don't want to disrespect her boundaries. But some days it's like if you went to a medical appointment and your doctor said he wouldn't be checking your blood pressure because he set a boundary.
Mm-hmm. So, Aisha, did you read that The Bustle essay by Rebecca Fishbane that was called Is Therapy Speak Making Us Selfish?
I saw it shared on Twitter, but I didn't read the whole thing.
Yeah. So I'm going to read you a little bit of it. The subhead is boundaries are important, but our relationships require a touch more compassion than some online blueprints offer. And she writes, when you're on the other side of someone's perhaps overzealous self-care, the experience can range from annoying to frustrating to downright hurtful. And it talks a lot about people sort of pushing off friends by saying things like, I'm in a place where I'm trying to honor my needs and act in alignment with what feels right with the scope of my life, and our friendship doesn't fit that framework. I think a lot of people could really relate to it, but my reaction when I read this and when I read that essay about therapy speak and friendship was, are you upset about the words the person is saying, or are you upset about what they're doing? And I think what might be helpful here is to forget about the language that's being used and look at what your coworker is actually doing when it comes to her job description, right? She's not doing the work. It doesn't really matter what she's saying, right?
Right. Interesting. I didn't think about that. My first thought was like, this just belongs in the group chat. This sounds like an annoying colleague who you can kind of like gripe about to whoever you vent all your stuff about. I don't think you need to go to the supervisor necessarily.
Oh, really? Okay, so we actually disagree on this, but go on. I'll let you say your part.
Yeah, I mean, so I get that, like, these are things that the colleagues should be doing anyway, but I think before you get to that point, maybe it's better to actually just talk to this colleague. And one of the ways that I found most effective, and a lot of teachers use this, but like, whenever you come across like a conundrum or an issue, or like you're faced with someone, whether it's a student or someone you're mentoring or whatever, and they tell you something, or even in therapy, and they, instead of like, you know, challenging you in a sort of like direct way, they ask you questions. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean by that? And I think maybe like next time this person says like, this is about my boundaries, or uses some sort of therapy speak, you could say like, you know, I notice you use that a lot. And I'm curious as to like what that means to you, or like how you are defining this. And then maybe that could lead to a conversation where you talk about like what the job description is and how, you know, there's like, there are levels to this. Like, sure, if you don't want to do this, you know, outside of your work hours, totally. Like, those are boundaries. Yes. But, you know, this is part of your job. So like, at least do it at some point, like do it when it needs to be done or before it needs to be out in the world or whatever. I think there's a way to maybe sort of approach this, that doesn't necessarily need to get the supervisor involved so quickly.
So good and so compassionate and such a great point. And this is why I've designed my whole life so that I never have to manage another human.
I mean, same.
I feel like these conversations are so difficult. And here's the script I wrote in my notes. You're going to die. If your boundaries prevent you from fulfilling your job description, we need to have a conversation about whether this is the right role for you.
So I think that's a great next step if that conversation doesn't go well, maybe. Mm-hmm. It also sounds like, I can't tell, wait, does this person say if they are above, like, are they, it sounds like they're a colleague who...
Yeah, it sounds like they're working on joint projects. But I guess what Elise does or doesn't do directly affects the letter writer. So yeah, it did first pop into my head, like, you need to... That's what I think a supervisor should say to this person. That's what I thought before you had your great idea to like have a thoughtful conversation with them.
Yeah, yeah. But I do think like, I think at a certain point, if Elise is not getting the picture, I think that your script is actually nice and spicy, but also just like realistic and just like, don't be annoying coworker. Cause this is just an annoying coworker.
Yeah. Like. But I mean, your questions are really good because there could be something going on Elise's end that we don't even know about. She could be working 80 hours a week. It could be that, three people on her team were recently laid off and she's been given all their work in addition to her regular job description. And this project she's working on with you is actually like making her work until midnight every night. And she has decided to set some boundaries to stick to her actual job. So it's good to think about the fact that there's a lot we don't know. And a boundary could just be like, I'm working the number of hours a week I'm paid for. And I'm not doing other people's jobs. It could be any number of things. So I think questioning is a great idea.
Yeah. And I also think like, but if that's the case, then Elise needs to explain that more. Like, you can't just throw around boundaries and then like, I mean, there's going to be people who are like, well, it's not like you don't have to disclose your medical. I'm not saying that, but I do think you have to say to some extent, like, even if it's like, she should at least be able to make up an excuse. Like, maybe it is a medical issue, or maybe there's something going on at home where like, she can't work outside of the hours that they're, you know, whatever. But she should at least have some sort of explanation beyond just throwing out these words, because it's not, you have to sort of, there's a give and take to these relationships, and there needs to be a little bit of understanding, or at least just like contextualizing why Elise is not really doing the things that she's necessarily supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I always feel like you've probably gone down the wrong path if you're like talking a lot about your boundaries and saying the word boundaries and announcing it. Like, the way to have a boundary at work would be like, hey, it's Monday morning. This is what's on my plate for the week. This is when I can file everything. I will let you know when it's ready for you to review. And then like the implication is like, I'm busy, I'm booked up, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and I'm not doing anything more at the last minute. So that's, to me, having a boundary, not just being like, nope, I have a boundary. Nope, I have a boundary. Same with friends, you know, like a boundary with a friend might be like, if you invite me out at the very last minute all the time as an afterthought, then sorry, like I already have plans. Not, I have a boundary with you and we're not close anymore, you know?
Exactly.
I just think people use the word wrong, and I don't blame the letter writer for being annoyed, but I would just say try to get to the meat of the issue and like what's actually behind this annoying therapy language.
Agree. Yes. I think we agreed on this more than you initially.
Okay. Thought. Yeah. Well, mostly because you convinced me of your point of view. This is Dear Prudence. We have to take a break, but when we come back, more letters from you and advice from us. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Can't get enough Dear Prudence? Then you should definitely join Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. You'll get to hear me answer an extra question every week just for members. With your subscription, you get ad-free listening across the Slate network and unlimited reading on the Slate site, including all Dear Prudence columns, past and present. Go to slate.com/prudyplus to sign up. It's just $15 for your first 3 months. Again, that's slate.com/prudyplus. Welcome back to Dear Prudence. I'm here with my guest, Aisha Harris, to answer your letters. Last letter for today, it is called, Can We Go to Croatia?
My ex and I were together for 3 years. We traveled a ton together in that time, both internationally and to U.S. national parks once COVID hit. Outside of our romantic relationship, we were very travel compatible. We enjoyed going at the same pace and wanted to do the same things. We broke up summer 2022, and other than generally bad timing, I was about to take the bar exam and had just moved in. It was a natural end to a relationship that had just run out of steam. Since then, with the help of respected therapists, we have been intentional about creating a friendship with lots of communication and boundaries. For example, we can talk to each other about our dating lives without any hurt feelings or jealousy. Lately, we have talked about how difficult it is to travel while single, as two people for whom travel is a major leisure priority. Friends in newer relationships only want to travel with significant others, and friends of different means have different travel goals. It is also difficult to find people you're travel compatible with. Last night, we started throwing around the idea of traveling together again. We both feel that we'll have a great time and it would not be weird at all. But while I'm fully prepared to talk to any future suitors about being friends with my ex, it feels like a whole other can of worms to explain that we are traveling internationally together. I also will have to repeatedly explain to my family and friends the situation. Basically, we will get a lot of side eye. Is it worth it? Is it only possible for us to travel together again in a group?
Why don't you two just get back together?
Oh my goodness. Okay, this is where we're going to disagree.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like they broke up for no real reason. Natural end. Okay. Apparently it wasn't a natural end because you still want to see each other and do these big trips and you still get along so well. So, I mean, I'm not saying automatically get back together, but go to Croatia, go to wherever and just don't put a label on it and just see what happens. Your thoughts?
So I think that TV and movies have poisoned our collective brain to believe that men and women can't just be friends. And men and women who have been together in the past cannot remain friends afterwards. And that there's always a will they or won't they, and like a they're gonna get back together, you know. Always happens. That was basically the whole concept of something like how I met your mother. Like it's like this, that is what has a lot of people think plays out in real life. And I think it's more complicated than that. Sure, there's a possibility that one or both of them is harboring secret feelings for the other still and is like, ooh, yeah. But I also fully understand this conundrum of wanting like travel and how thorny and tricky it can be, because it's true. Once you reach a certain age, a lot of people only want to travel with their significant others, or like travel with their significant others and other couples. Or, you know, friends have different ways. Some people, when they go out, they want to just relax by the pool all day, and other people like want to go out and go party. That's a problem. And I can understand there are people who may not romantically anymore, like no longer be compatible. But like there's these other aspects of their life where they are compatible and they can hang. And I don't know. I just feel like they should go to Croatia. And I don't think that like they're going to. Well, my question is, are you all going to share a room?
Great question.
Because, you know. Because, you know, you also have to prepare yourself for like there could be temptation. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that they are still interested in each other as dating partners. They could just, you know, maybe they hook up still. I don't know. I feel like there's nothing wrong with that. As long as you're being open and intentional.
Well, let me push back as like the unevolved backward person in this conversation. Okay, imagine you're the future suitor and this person's going, yeah, we travel together and, you know, we do share a room. And yeah, we did occasionally hook up. And we're going on another trip, but this time it's just fine. We're totally just friends. I mean, I just feel like the letter writer's concerns about how future partners might see the situation are valid.
But I think once you start having a relationship with a new person, I don't necessarily think that means that she's going to keep going on international trips with this person. They're both single. I think what she's saying is that like the idea of explaining the fact that they're still friends just generally is something that she's prepared to do. Like she's not going to like ditch this guy once she finds someone else. She's going to still be friends with him. But I don't think necessarily that means they're going to take trips together without each other's significant others.
Right. And the great thing about trips is that you plan them a few months in advance, right? And you plan them generally one at a time. So it's not as if you have to plan 5 years worth of trips and the trips are just going to happen regardless of who finds a girlfriend or boyfriend. You can evaluate before each trip, hey, is there anyone in your life who would feel uncomfortable with this? Is this a good time for you? Like, do you feel free to do this? And if you do, you go and then you get back and kind of like start back at baseline and reevaluate.
Yeah, I don't know. I say this as someone who has hung out with my partner's ex before. And, you know, at first I thought it was weird, but then I was like, yeah, whatever. I'm not concerned about them. Like, they had their thing and they're clearly not interested in each other anymore. So whatever. I also think like the concern about like, having to explain to your family and friends the situation. No, you don't. Like,
yeah,
I understand that people have different dynamics with their friends and family, but I've never been someone, I love my family. They're great. I've never been someone who like was overly concerned about how they felt about my dating life or any aspect of my life. I'm just like, you know, here's this person I'm dating and maybe we'll be in a few months. So I've never had that concern, but I think like that's none of their business. Like if you tell them and you have friends who joke about it, you might have to like deal with that and roll with the punches because like people are probably going to, you know, make cracks about it if they don't freak out about it. So just prepared for that. Other than that, I think like go to Croatia. Maybe you all hook up. Maybe you all really can just have a platonic friendship that involves international waters and travel. I don't know. I think this is healthy and cool. Like, hopefully the ex isn't harboring secret feelings or hoping that they get back together. It doesn't sound like it, but, you know, sometimes we can be very oblivious or, like, want to convince ourselves that, like, oh, this person is totally cool that we broke up. It's fine. That doesn't always work out, so just be mindful of that, but I don't know. I'm rooting for them. I want them to go to Croatia.
Yeah. At least have the ability to have your own room and like your own way home and whatever. If things somehow like emotionally blow up or if there's a misunderstanding, I totally agree that I don't care what the friends and family think at all. Now, again, if one of my friends decided to go abroad with an ex, I would be not side-eyeing because it wouldn't be negative. I'd be like, so?
That's totally fair.
And they might just say like nothing, it's really nothing, and I would have to leave it alone, and I don't think anyone would be harmed by that interaction.
And then you're scrolling through Instagram and you see them on like next to a waterfall and you're like, you guys look very cozy together. I think friends and family have every right to make jokes or kind of like to a point and then like let it lie, but like just be prepared for that.
Those are all the questions we have. As always, I hope we've been at least a little bit helpful. Thank you so much, Aisha, for being here. This is so much fun. Thank you for bringing your like TV and pop culture knowledge to the situation.
I can't have a single conversation without at least mentioning one or two TV shows or movies. So thank you for indulging me.
Pre-order your copy of Aisha's debut book, Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me, where she mines the benchmarks of her 90s childhood and beyond to analyze the tropes that are shaping all of us and our ability to shape them right back. Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me is out June 13th. And I have had the chance to read it. It's really, really good. Get that book. Do you need help getting along with partners, relatives, coworkers, and people in general? Write to me. Go to slate.com/prudy. That's slate.com/PRUDIE. The Dear Prudence column publishes every Thursday, and you can join us for the Prudy live chat on Mondays at noon Eastern.
And if you'd like to hear your question answered on the podcast, we're looking for letter writers who would be comfortable reading their questions for the show. You can stay anonymous.
Dear Prudence is produced by Sierra Spragley-Ricks, with a special thanks to Brandon Nix. Editorial help from Paola De Verona. Daisy Rosario is senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of audio. I'm your Dear Prudence, Janae Desmond-Harris. Until next time.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.